This is 1A. I'm Sasha Ann Simons in Maryland. Black Lives Matter. In the midst of nationwide protests condemning systemic violence against Black Americans, we at 1A support protesters' demands for a right to live and to hold police accountable for using deadly force against Black people. This is a show about free speech. The First Amendment, it's in our name, 1A. Is it partisan for the press to say Black Lives Matter? Newsrooms across the country are debating the role that journalists should be playing, and particularly when it comes to talking about race in America. In a 2016 conversation with NPR's Code Switch, then Washington Post reporter Wesley Lowery had this to say about the idea of objectivity.
I don't even like the word objectivity. When we talk about trying to be objective, we begin the conversation with a lie. Like, we begin the conversation with the lie that we don't have biases and that we don't perceive the world certain ways, right? I strive to be fair. And that fairness means that I have to interrogate my own biases. That fairness means I have to go out of my way to make sure I'm giving a fair, good faith hearing to people who I know I disagree with.
Journalists at the New York Times revolted over an op-ed which many said threatened Black lives. That same week, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette barred some of its Black reporters from covering the protests over fears that they'd be, quote, too biased. And on the other hand, just yesterday, the news organization Axios announced that its reporters can participate in protests and that a company fund would cover bail for any employee who is arrested. Some newsrooms across the country appear to be changing fast. What could that mean for journalism? And is it possible to be fair and transparent without being objective? I'll tell you, this is a conversation that the 1A team is having a lot. And we should note that we reached out to NPR, whose standards and guidelines we abide by, but they declined to take part in the program. Joining us is Ricardo Sandoval-Paulos, public editor for PBS. Ricardo, welcome to 1A.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Also here is Nicole Hannah-Jones, reporter for the New York Times Magazine covering racial injustice. Nicole, welcome back.
Thank you.
Nicole, I'll start with you. In the past 2 weeks, we've seen several incidents involving newsrooms scrutinizing journalists of color over their inability to be objective. Here's that word again. Talk to us about some of those incidents.
Well, we've seen really three major incidents, and who knows how many others where journalists haven't spoken out about them. But we have the case in Pittsburgh, and that was where, of course, two Black journalists, one a photojournalist, one a print journalist, were taken off of the beat to be able to cover the protest. The Black journalist had posted on social media images of trash everywhere, of garbage everywhere, and said, oh, look at, you know, these looters, and then said, actually, it's the end of a Kenny Chesney tailgate. And I guess her bosses thought that that was inappropriate and pulled her off of the coverage. Okay. We still have no explanation about why the photojournalist, who is also a Black journalist, was pulled off of the coverage. And then, go ahead.
And tell me about what happened at your paper, the Senator Tom Cotton's op-ed.
Sure. So we ran online an op-ed written by Tom Cotton that was basically calling for the U.S. military to be imposed on cities and states where the governors did not want that help in order to put down protests that they felt were violent. There was a huge pushback amongst journalists at the New York Times. More than 1,000 journalists signed a letter put forth by our union saying we oppose that. And a lot of journalists went and spoke online about it. And it was for two reasons. One, this editorial did not go through the proper normal fact-checking process that anything that appears in the Times should go through. But we also felt we were giving kind of free space to a sitting U.S. senator to suppress the free speech rights of Americans, mm-hmm. and that platform should not be given over in that way.
Yeah,
that this would have been a news story, and as a news story, it would have been fine, but not to allow to be a newspaper and allow someone to talk about using the military to repress free speech was too far for many of us.
Mm-hmm. A lot of journalists were upset about that. I remember waking up that morning, looking at Twitter and just seeing the uproar, right? Also, the opinion editor, James Bennett, he resigned on Sunday. How significant is that part, Nicole?
You know, it's complicated. I've worked with James Bennett, and I certainly don't want to speak on kind of internal personnel matters, but...
Do you think that was necessary, him resigning?
I think he made the decision that he felt he needed to make. We certainly... as journalists at the New York Times, wanted this to be taken seriously, and it appears that it was.
Ricardo, let's bring you in here. Lay out what this debate is around objectivity. What's it about? What has objectivity meant up until this point? And then why is it now being called into question?
Well, I think, you know, I think one of the fundamental problems with the word objectivity is, and in this case, you know, and on that point, I do agree strongly with what Wes was recorded saying earlier, is that it really doesn't exist, frankly. I think it's been a word that's been overused by our industry in an attempt to portray us playing both sides or trying to reflect all sides of an issue equally. And you can't do that. And the main reason you can't do that is because we're humans. Mm-hmm. As humans, we have subjective impulses. We make suggestive and subjective decisions every step of the way in a news gathering. We decide what stories to go after. We decide what headlines to put over a story. As humans, we make the subjective decisions into how we're going to write the story, how the story will be edited. So every step of the way, there's a subjective measure that's used to present news. And I've long preached that instead of objectivity, we need to rely, number one, on accuracy. And number two is not even so much fairness. I think you need to be transparent. Mm-hmm. And so transparency and accuracy will give you the kind of journalism that I believe can show readers and show audiences and listeners that we're approaching this with a right amount of fairness and foremost looking at making sure that we are right. And so I'm a firm believer in activist journalism. I mean, I think you can have a position and you can take a position, but you need to be right. And you need to do it in a way that's transparent and that also shows that you took the time to be introspective about your own work and are presenting it in possibly the fairest possible fashion.
Ignacio tweeted to us and said, journalists' personal opinions are irrelevant and polluting to uncovering and accurately reporting truth and facts, which is the actual purpose of journalism to begin with. One's idiosyncrasies and personal bias must be left at the door, but not one's identity. Your response, Ricardo?
Well, I think in a way, you know, you can't avoid who you are when you're acting as even as a professional. You can't leave that at the door. Mm-hmm. But what you can do is approach a subject, approach a story with the right amount, with the right goal. And that goal has to be accuracy. And you can be accurate. Accuracy doesn't know your skin color or doesn't know your political allegiance or alliance. This is something that we need to be taking and using as the foremost goal in how we approach our work.
We are talking with Ricardo Sandoval-Paulos. He's the public editor of PBS, and Nicole Hannah-Jones, reporter for the New York Times Magazine covering racial justice. Nicole, here's a tweet from Murph. Murph says, I think everyone has bias. Why does it seem only black journalists are moved off protests? Do white journalists not also have bias? It tells black people their reality is a bias. It's shameful. What do you say to that, Nicole?
I mean, I think he is speaking to something that so many journalists of color feel frustration about, is because we live in a majority white country where whiteness is considered normative, there's seldom these conversations where we're believing that white reporters are reporting through a racial lens. But of course, white reporters are reporting through a racial lens. None of us in this country are free of having a racialized experience and racialized identity. But it is often black reporters, Asian, Latino reporters, Native reporters who are told we're perceived to wear our bias on our skin. And so mm-hmm. people presume, white editors, the public presume that we are biased because of our race. But clearly, that's not the case. And we see that in coverage all of the time. I mean, we didn't talk about Philadelphia, where the Philadelphia Inquirer ran a headline that said, buildings matter too. Yeah. And the editor of that newspaper was forced to resign over that. That's a bias. That is coming from a framework of whiteness where property is treated the same as a loss of Black life. So yes, we're always having to push against this. I've had to push against this my entire career.
Ronald commented on our Facebook page, "It is impossible to leave one's identity at the door. The best we can hope for is self-examination to minimize what biases we have." Another tweet here from Dan saying, "I have no bias" is like saying, "I don't see color" in order to address possible concerns for bias or racism. You have to first acknowledge that it exists. Does that sound about right to you, Nicole?
Absolutely.
I see no color. I don't see color. That's a touchy one.
Well, yeah. And it's a lie. Unless you're colorblind, you see color.
Of course.
I think what I say all the time is the only thing that any human being is not objective about are things that we don't know enough about to have formed an opinion. And as soon as you know enough about something, you have an opinion about it. So I agree. I've long said there's no such thing as objectivity. I do believe we have to be fair.
Yeah.
And the only way you can be fair is to understand what your biases are in your reporting and report against them.
The debate over objectivity in journalism is not only about how journalists report on a subject, but who is reporting. The recent controversies in several newsrooms involving journalists of color have underscored why there's a lack of diversity in newsrooms. We're speaking with Nicole Hannah-Jones and Ricardo Sandoval-Palos. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or perfect strangers? Get the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
This week on It's Been a Minute, I talk out the news with my Aunt Betty.
I'm more concerned about the Black men that I love than anything in the world because I just don't want to get that call.
Also, parenting in the age of Black Lives Matter and the history of police reform. Listen and subscribe to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
This is 1A. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We're discussing objectivity in journalism with Nicole Hannah-Jones, reporter for the New York Times Magazine, and Ricardo Sandoval-Palos, public editor for PBS. Let's add another voice to the conversation. Our very own 1A producer, Morgan Givens, is with us. Morgan, welcome to 1A.
What's up, Sasha? How are you?
Doing good. Now, Morgan, as a 1A producer, you know that this conversation hits close to home for us. Our team is having several conversations about this. We're grappling with everything that we're talking about right now. Part of this debate is how we as journalists are supposed to express ourselves on social media.
Sure.
I, as a Black journalist at the helm of this show, it's something I think about every time I step on Twitter. But recently you tweeted that President Trump was a white supremacist fascist. As a journalist, how are you defending that tweet?
I tweeted that, and I also tweeted there is a white supremacist fascist in the White House. And when you have the understanding of what white supremacy is and how it functions as a system, you cannot help but see that truth. And the problem that I am seeing, you know, when people point at me and say, how can you say that? I'm looking at them like, how do you not have the knowledge of the institution in which you work so that you cannot see it? How do you not have the historical awareness and the subjectivity and everything and the knowledge that makes it so you can actually remove yourself as much as possible intellectually from the white supremacist system in which we all function to actually name it? And the reason that that caused such a furor, I'm guessing, in the editorial building or, you know, in editorial staff meetings or whatever the case may be, is because the inability to call out fascism is directly linked to journalists' inability to call out white supremacy in the United States because the two are so inextricably tied. And so I stand by what I said because it's the truth. And it's the truth cannot be held hostage or captive for those who do not know it yet and for those who have not done the reading yet and for those who do not understand that it is a constant life battle to unlearn what this white supremacist capitalist patriarchal system has taught us. And so unlearning that means that we have to also unmask the things that make it so we cannot call the truth the truth. That means we have to point to the guidelines that say Black journalists need to be silent in the face of what they know to be true and then also acknowledge that these guidelines are based in the white supremacist idea of objectivity. So I said what I said because it's true. I said what I said because I have the knowledge to know that it's true, because I have done the reading, because I can contextualize history and where we are in this moment. And so the inability of others to do so, sadly, to be in the positions where you are making editorial decisions, that's not my fault. So
now,
that's how I stand by it.
Do you then, Morgan, do you not believe that journalists are representing their organizations online, and that certain tweets could call into question the credibility of the organization itself? Or when you tweet, do you see it as, this is me, Morgan, tweeting?
My thing is, if the reputation of your organization can be called into question by the truth, that's a problem with the organization. That's a problem with what the organization thinks it stands for and what it's supposed to do. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Ricardo, what's your take? Are we tweeting as ourselves, or are we tweeting on behalf of these organizations that we work for?
Boy, I tell you, that's a real tough one because, we all have a voice and we all should be feeling free enough to be able to say what we believe and what our emotions tell us that we want to put out. And that's what social media is all about. The difficulty becomes when you're, what's called in the business a public-facing employee. And a lot of news organizations, the majority of news organizations have decided that if you're in that position, all of your social media commentary represents the organization, represents the news outlet. And so that's what's created a lot of the controversy that's out there. I think one of the undertones as well is that there are two principal fears by the folks who run these newsrooms. And one is that that you as a journalist, if you say something, if you expose your emotions and what you feel online and in social media, that's going to disable you from being able to cover issues because people will perceive a bias in you. Secondarily, and I think a real fear among a lot of bosses is frankly that your social media posts are actionable. They can be used against you in court if there's a case of libel or defamation. Lawyers have successfully asked for social media records of reporters in the past in an effort to reveal bias. Mm-hmm. And bias is one of the things that could potentially trigger a legal action. So I think that is where the nub of the conflict really lies.
Mm-hmm.
But I really would hate to see us shutting down people when they say something online. And maybe online we ought to be held to that same standard of truth. I mean, I've written before that, as a Latino journalist, and when I saw the president coming down the escalator in 2016 when he began his campaign and saying that that we were, we were all rapists and that my native country didn't send the best and the brightest to the U.S., immediately I just felt a very visceral threat. And so how do you respond to that? I responded by saying that if I point out something that I know to be demonstrably correct and accurate, then you can't say that I'm biased for having said that.
But you're also speaking to us now as a public editor for PBS. So what is that? Tell us what that role is exactly.
Well, basically, I'm the ombudsman. And so what I do is I listen to our audiences on digital and on video and wherever else PBS, the PBS signal is seen and heard. And I gather up the opinions and the complaints of our audiences, and I take it back to our producers and our content providers throughout the organization. And I say, hey, there's a concern about a spot on the news hour.
Mm-hmm.
Or my very first column was about concerns that some people had about the same-sex marriage portrayed in the cartoon Arthur. And then you look at the issue, you look at the conflict, and you write an opinion piece basically on what the impact of that is. And in some cases, you're asked to decide whether the concerns are legitimate or not.
We're talking with Ricardo Sandoval-Palos, public editor of PBS. Also with us is Nicole Hannah-Jones, reporter for the New York Times Magazine covering racial justice, and Morgan Givens, our very own producer for 1A. Morgan, consider this tweet here from Haley. She says, I want sterile, boring, factual news. No leanings, no bias, just reporting. Most news is not news anymore. It's an op-ed production. The line between media and social media has blurred beyond recognition. Good and bad intentions are easy to find, but the truth isn't. Your response?
My response to that is that in some aspects, I completely understand where this person is coming from, but we cannot ignore the fact that media in this country, specifically white journalistic institutions, have an inability to recognize a white supremacist system for what it is and an inability to put that in the historical context so that people actually understand what is happening right now in our country. So to say that we can only give people the facts, what good do facts do me? What good does knowing 1 + 1 = 2 do me if I do not know what to do with 2? Mm-hmm. And so we often find ourselves in these situations where we wake up and we'll say to people, you know, as journalists, hey, today, you know, the Senate voted this way and the Democrats voted this way, and here's where we are with the law, without actually telling people in that moment, here are all the ways they said they were going to do X, Y, and Z, and they never did it. Here are all the ways, no matter what side of the aisle you fall upon, that the government, the power that the journalists are supposed to check and hold to account, have failed the people of the United States of America. And I have said it once, and I will say it again, that I feel you. I am sorry that we have failed you, because we have failed this person that they're calling in this way, because I said it once and I'll say it again. The job of journalism in the United States is to trouble power, and power is not troubled by white journalistic institutions right now, because in order to trouble that power, they have to recognize the white supremacist system in which we all live and operate, so that they can check that and then recognize the white supremacist system in which they operate and perpetuate within these organizations, within member stations, within all types of media. How can we expect journalists to hold a mirror up to the country if they have not held it up to themselves? That is what I am saying.
Nicole.
Does that make sense? And so I feel her. We failed her.
Nicole, I want you to close in on this. Morgan brings up interesting points. The facts versus the truth. Whose truth is the truth? Is there one truth?
It depends on the situation. And I think this leads to like a fundamental misunderstanding of what journalism is. Journalism is not stenography. We don't simply say Donald Trump said this, Nancy Pelosi said this. That should not be our role. Our role should actually be at getting at the truth and providing context and analysis so people understand what this means. I mean, we saw this as really problematic, for instance, around climate change. You know, 98% of scientists agree on climate change, but we saw media giving that 2% the same weight as a 98%. That's not helpful to Americans. The reason we have the First Amendment and the reason a free press is necessary is democracy does not work if citizens are not informed, and simply saying this person said that and this person said this is not actually informing the public. I also think many white Americans have believed that news before that was less diverse was just simply the facts. Mm-hmm. Black Americans never had that luxury, because simply the facts excluded us, demeaned us, and degraded us. When you look at, let's just take Eric Garner. The facts were that the police said Eric Garner resisted arrest and accidentally died. Then that is what the media reported based on the facts of a police report. Mm-hmm. A few weeks later, we got new facts. And those new facts were, we had a video showing that he was actually strangled to death. So when we think about what mainstream media has done, is it has long tended to believe power. It has long tended to operate as stenographers of power. And we've taken that to be non-biased, objective reporting. It has not been. Black Americans have never been able to prescribe to this belief of of being objective, because objective reporting was what allowed us to be treated so poorly and not to be believed through all of American media, and continues to be the case. So when white Americans to me say, I just want factual reporting, what they're saying to me is they want reporting from a white perspective that fits in with a white normative view. And that simply has never been objective. Let's just be frank.
And this tweet from Daniela seems to fit right along the lines of some of the things you were saying, Nicole. She says, a few days ago, a black colleague said when he got his start in the 1970s, only he and other African-American journalists were asked if they could be objective while covering race relations. White reporters were assumed to be objective. Now, I want to bring this statement in because we talked about Morgan, our 1A producer, and his recent tweets about the president of the United States. And we have a statement here from 1A's executive producer, Rupert Allman. He prepared this for the conversation. He said, Morgan and I talked last week. To be clear, as the executive producer, I wasn't interested in shutting Morgan down. I did ask whether he saw NPR and public media as a natural home. That's what I want it to be. I also understand Morgan has had to put up with comments and behavior that has made that difficult for him, which of course I regret. But calling the president a fascist does more than fall foul of existing NPR guidelines, guidelines that are under review and need updating. It misreads history. The president is a populist and fiercely individualistic. Fascism relies on the collective and is built around an ideology where all powers are centralized. Neither, in my view, jive with President Trump's worldview. Morgan and I don't agree. It's a healthy disagreement. I hope this conversation provides some attention on the need to set new standards for those who are committed to upholding the highest standards expected from those working in public media. Morgan, what's your response to this statement?
My response to that statement is, Rupert, I appreciate you writing it, but what good does it do me for you to be upset about things that have happened when you as a person in position of power could have addressed those things? The second thing I will say to that is that you talk about a consolidation of power. What has happened with our Senate? Is that not a consolidation of power when they have abdicated their role, their constitutionally mandated role? Is that not an abdication? Should we wait until power has been abdicated entirely, completely, before we call it out for what it is? Do we wait for fascism to be to the point where we can no longer call it out before we say what it is? Because yes, historically, what I am saying is actually 100% accurate. You do not wait for the building to crumble to point out its cracks. You can be a person who is a fascist and just not be in a position to actually engage in all the fascist behaviors you want to, because thank God there are still some checks and balances in our democracy. But those checks and balances do not hold. And the mistake white journalists make is believing that because democracy has always been, and it ain't even been a true democracy in the United States of America, but because what we have has always existed or has existed for the last 300-400 years since people came and stole this land, because it has existed, they think it will always continue to. You must fight for what you want to be. You must fight for what you know to be true. And I will not back down, because what I know is that I am right. And what I know is that often people in positions of power do not want that power questioned, because questioning that power means to question the entire undergirding of the system. That is my response to that.
And Ricardo, your response, just is this something that you would flag as a PBS public editor, you know, thinking about Morgan's tweet and then Rupert's response? What are your thoughts?
You know, I think that's a healthy debate. I think it's a kind of debate that needs to be happening in all of our newsrooms. We need to be asking ourselves, where do we stand on these things?
I said 1A is having this discussion. I wasn't lying.
Yeah,
this is a fact.
I know. and really, I hope and I pray that other outlets are having similar discussions and conversations about the role of the people inside of the organizations and the voice that we all want to have in decision making and deciding the direction of our editorial policies and our news coverage. I think the thing that bugs a lot of people, and I will include myself in there, is that, you know, when you look at an administration that takes the actions that it does, and when you look at a presidency that stokes discontent, that stokes hate in many quarters, you can't help but see evidence of a certain pattern of behavior, mm-hmm. which a lot of people would call racist. So, you know, it goes back to that adage again that, yes, and I agree 100%, we are not stenographers.
Yeah.
And if you have two people sitting at a window and one of them says, hey, it's raining outside, and objectivity would then beckon you to say,
yeah,
ask the other person, do you agree? And the other person says no. Our job as journalists is to look outside the window and say, hey, it's raining.
Right.
You know, and so those are the kinds of discussions that we do need to be having inside of our newsrooms today.
Cecilia tweeted, we all need to ask, what am I missing here? What do I not see? Identities cannot be left at the door because they're shaped by our lived experiences. However, we need to be curious about experiences of others and not look to shape them through our filters. We're talking to Nicole Hannah-Jones, Morgan Givens, and Ricardo Sandoval-Palos. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. More from our guests and from you in just a moment.
As protests sweep the nation, the subject of policing is once again being hotly debated.
This week on Throughline, how police forces developed in the North and the South in the 19th century and expanded their power in the 20th century.
Throughline from NPR, the podcast where we go back in time
to understand the present.
Now, journalists of color have been clamoring for change within the media industry for years. Will this moment be the turning point? We're speaking with Nicole Hannah-Jones of the New York Times, Morgan Givens, producer for 1A, and Ricardo Sandoval-Palos, public editor for PBS. Nicole, many journalists have called for the use of more direct language, and you hinted at this earlier. I'm thinking especially when it comes to talking about Trump, for example, calling his rhetoric racist, not racially charged or racially tinged. I can't tell you how many times I, as a race reporter in D.C., had to fight that term in my newsroom. You know, tell us why language is important here.
Well, I mean, what we do for a living is language, and we know that specificity and accuracy is critical. It's interesting in a conversation about objectivity and when there are all these accusations against Black and brown journalists that they are not objective enough, that we have to have arguments about using words like racially tinged, racially charged, because that is a sign of subjectivity. That is a sign of discomfort with calling something what it objectively is. Again, the people making these decisions are not making objective decisions. They are uncomfortable with the terminology. They are worried about what their white readers will think if they use that terminology. But our job is to be accurate. And if the most accurate depiction of something that the president of the United States says is the word racist, we need to say racist. Mm-hmm. Now, I agree. I'm not interested in calling, determining whether Donald Trump himself is racist or not. That's not the role of a journalist. But we certainly need to call out actions and statements that are clearly racist and stop being uncomfortable with using what is actually the correct and most accurate language.
We got several voicemails from listeners on the issue of whether journalists should be expected to leave their identities at the door or whether there's value in bringing their identities with them.
Hello, my name is Victor. I'm calling from over in Champlin, Minnesota. I very firmly believe that reporters need to check their identities at the door.
Hi, this is Bree from Salt Lake City. I do not believe that journalists should be required to check their identity at the door. I think that each individual's experience and opinion and insight is valuable and should be heard.
I'm Eric from Grand Rapids, Minnesota. And as soon as a journalist or a reporter starts to show their political bias, they've lost. We need trust in the community and we need facts. We don't need people's opinions.
Hi, this is Maria from Hoffman Estates, Illinois. I don't think that journalists should check their identities at the door. I think it's important for everyone to get a different perspective. Black people and white people are going to experience an event or a time in history differently. Basically the equivalent of saying I don't see color, and we need to see color. We need to see everyone.
Thank you, Victor, Bree, Eric, and Maria, for leaving us those voicemails. Nicole, is leaving your identity at the door even possible? And should that even be the goal?
I don't even understand what that means.
Right. Just don't be Black for a second.
Right.
Can you just not be Black for a moment?
Right. Don't be white. Don't be a woman. Don't be a person from a small town in the Midwest. Like it's a nonsensical thing. I get the goal that they're trying to get at, which is to report without bias, but that is a ridiculous thing. And it's literally only used against marginalized people. Because if you are a non-marginalized person who belongs to a non-marginalized group, you don't tend to see yourself as having a specific identity that impacts the way you see the world. You actually believe that you see the world in an objective way. What we're saying is that has never been the case. And what is much more important is to understand, I became a journalist because of how I grew up, of the injustices I saw, of not being reflected in media, of seeing the way that my community was portrayed inaccurately is what made me want to become a journalist. And if you have diverse newsrooms, then you have different editors and people within your newsrooms who are looking at your reporting, even mine, and saying, that doesn't actually feel quite right there. So I think we really need to think about what are we asking for when we tell people to check their identities at the door? And what do we mean when we say just the facts? What are the facts? We actually don't all agree on the facts or the interpretation of those facts or what those facts actually mean. And what you're really asking for is to people to have the normative identity that you hold. And that's simply not reflective of America. And I don't think that's accurate reporting.
Morgan, you've been quite vocal on Twitter. What do you have to say about Twitter itself as a space for journalists of color to express themselves?
Twitter is not a safe space for Black or brown people, period. Let alone if you are a journalist who is now in a position where you are trying to help, because that is all we have been trying to do. Yo, y'all are looking at this wrong. You're not doing it right. You're missing the point because you grew up in this one perspective. You've been fed this white supremacist ideology, and that infects everything you do and everything you view and how you attempt to go out and help people make sense of the way power dynamics move and operate in this world. And so when I have a place like Twitter, I am a Black trans man. I have no choice but to speak when I have the option, because my entire life has been speaking out against the people and the forces and the power systems that seek my destruction and wish I did not exist. So am I going to use every platform I have? Yes. Does that mean every platform is the best? No. There's a reason that most Black people who are in these positions as journalists have to diversify their portfolio. We've seen them talking about it on Twitter because we know and we understand that to do this job accurately, to do this job in the way that white producers and white journalists say they want it done, to understand how to remove ourselves from this and check our own impulses. That is what I have to do as a Black producer and a Black person who is a journalist. I have to go, is the fact that I am trans making me miss this? Is the fact that I am Black making me miss this? I have yet to hear a white journalist or a white producer say, is the fact that I am white and I grew up in a white supremacist society within a white supremacist system impacting the way in which I cover this story? So, you know, that is why you see Black journalists busting out receipts on Twitter. Is why you
see
them.
Some white journalists are starting to say that now that there's lots of attention.
Exactly. They're saying it now, but who had to take the risk initially? That is what always it always comes down to, asking those with the most to lose to take the risk. And then we turn around and we're like, well, finally, you're here. Get there faster. You're in the position of power. You're in the position of leadership. Quit asking us and do it because you've been told. And so when people go on Twitter and they're like, Twitter fingers are rapid, it's because they've been ignored. It's because that's the platform that is available. Now, imagine how your institution has made it so that Black journalists and producers cannot tell you the truth about yourself if they have to go on Twitter, a place that is notoriously bad and dangerous for Black and brown people to voice their concerns.
So
we have to kind of go back. You have to pull the thread and understand what we're unraveling and where we're going.
Ricardo, here's a tweet from Dominic. Dominic says, how is identity taught and discussed in the process of becoming a journalist, particularly for folks with very salient identities? Is that something that should change?
Well, you know, I think it's a fascinating question because, you know, I'll tell you, I've been a professional journalist for at least 30 years now. My very first story, the very first piece I wrote, questioned the police shooting of a young Latino in my hometown in San Diego. And I haven't looked back ever since. But I've also had to endure, like a lot of us have had to endure, is the natural tendency of this business. But listen, we're at 77% of our industry is non-Hispanic white. And that's even a greater disparity than the general workplace in the United States. So if you have that kind of a dynamic going into a workplace, you can expect that the prevailing train of thought, that the prevailing worldview is going to be conflicted with the way you see the world and the way I've seen the world as a Latino journalist, you know? So there is that natural conflict, and you do have to fight against it, and you do have to do a fair amount of education of of your colleagues. And what's frustrating to me, what's been frustrating to me for 4 decades now, is the fact that it hasn't changed all that much, that we still have to endure indignities in the workplace, that we still have to endure things that affect us that our white colleagues perhaps can't relate to, like me being asked to show my ID, to show proof of citizenship and residency on a train between San Diego and Los Angeles. I'm a college graduate, and I still had to show the dang ID.
Yeah.
You know, so it's those kinds of things that aren't shared with the majority of the people in our workplace.
Nicole, what do you want to add?
Well, I was just going to say, I wish that our white colleagues and white Americans would understand, you know, if you've grown up in a community where police have always treated you respectfully and have always served, if you've grown up in a community where your schools were always high functioning and well resourced, where you could walk into any business and no one is assuming that you are the help, that absolutely colors how you perceive those institutions and how you cover them and what you think the stories are. So, you know, this notion that it's just our experience that makes us see the world a certain way is not true. You know, when I first started writing about school resegregation in 2014, there was virtually no coverage of school segregation as problematic amongst education reporters who are very heavily white and women. We would be in complete denial to think that the fact that they were white women, many of them who had their own children who were attending segregated schools that were beneficial to them, that did not have an impact on what they were covering and what they weren't covering. So again, we really need to understand that all of our racialized experiences as journalists lead us to cover things a certain way, but also determine what the public sees as just the facts. Just the facts are what a reporter decides he or she wants to cover, whether their editor thinks that's important or not, whether they think it should go on the first page or not. But those aren't all the facts that are available. Those are the facts that people have made subjective decisions about.
We have a couple of people who wrote to us about activism and journalism. Anise tweets, okay, we're not stenographers. We're shaped by our experiences. But should there be a distinction between activism and partisanship and journalism? Emilio also tweeted and said, it's interesting to finally hear this discussion in the U.S. because there's been a long tradition of what you called activist journalism in Latin America. You can hear this reflected in the approach of, for example, Jorge Ramos. Maybe public service journalism is a better term. Nicole?
Yeah, so one, even in the United States, this notion of objective journalism is fairly recent. That wasn't how journalism and newspapers originally were in this country either. I'll say that I believe all journalism is activism in that we see our job as holding powerful people accountable. That is not a neutral position, but it is important. For instance, if I'm covering the New York City public schools, I don't think it is helpful for people to know my personal thoughts on the chancellor. I think that I should keep that to myself because that will inhibit my reporting if I let that be known. I understand why political reporters don't want to tell you their personal thoughts on political candidates. I think there are certain things that we should adhere to as journalists, but we should not pretend that we have no feelings. We should not pretend that we don't have thoughts on the things that we cover because we do. Mm-hmm. And this is what I do think is a challenge of social media, is that once you are supposed to have personality, it's supposed to kind of offer a personal end to the public, to who you are, but we also are expected to, quote unquote, be objective journalists. And I think that tension is constantly being revealed and pushed in, and I clearly don't adhere to any of that.
We're almost out of time. Gosh, we could do another hour on this. But I wanted to throw in very quickly a comment on our Facebook from Anne. She says, I think it's essential to have wide diversity among journalists in race, gender, political ideas, economic realities, but they should strive to do their reporting as neutrally as possible. If you have a diverse newsroom, they can check each other's biases. Ricardo, can you weigh in on that?
That's a nice goal.
Yeah.
And I think it's actually something that might even organically take place when you do diversify a newsroom, when there is a conversation, such as the one that you're having in your station, and the
right.
kind of conversation that I believe is happening throughout the country. I mean, I think the bottom line, though, is that we do need to have an increase in diversity in news coverage by reporters and editors. I think one of the things that, and maybe this makes me a bad editor, but I remember seeing a sign up once in the office of an editor that said, check your ego or leave your ego at the door. And I tell my reporters, I said, listen, no, I want your ego engaged. You are a badass reporter. I want you to challenge me. I want you to show me that the story you wrote is correct and the best possible approach to this story, and I want us to have that conversation. So I think that kind of conversation is absolutely necessary in the workplace. And I'm working, day and night. My goal is to have an increased presence, journalists of color, in newsrooms, even if we are shrinking. We're going to chase diversity to all the new platforms that are coming out.
20 seconds to go. Nicole, many journalists of color, we saw Morgan, he's on the show this hour. They've spoken out publicly against the practices of their newsrooms, who've been scrutinized for their lack of objectivity, garnering widespread support. Real quick, does this make you hopeful at all?
It makes me hopeful that young journalists and journalists of color feel more empowered, but I also know that there are repercussions for this and many of them will face them.
Nicole Hannah-Jones is a reporter for the New York Times Magazine, Morgan Givens, a producer for 1A, and Ricardo Sandoval-Palos, public editor for PBS. Thank you all so much. Great discussion. This conversation was produced by Haley Blassingame and edited by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.